concentration and the promotion of lots of voices from around the world. We'll obviously get into that in a second. Just one literal administrative thing, which is we will not meet next week, the 9th. Some people have been asking about this. There's no class on the 9th. We will be meeting on the 16th and the 23rd for sure, and we'll be updating the website shortly with all of that. But no class on the 9th next week.
Mine broke.
And I promise only one administrative announcement. The second one, we did get the reaction papers from, I think, everybody or close to everybody from the INS conference in December. Thank you for all of that. And if there are elements of what you wrote about in that that are able to be brought into the conversation today, that would be particularly good. Part of our reasoning for the topic we have today in Global Voices was as a segue from what many of you wrote in those papers. So hopefully that will come forward. Thanks. Good morning.
All right. I could, I think, perhaps better title what I'm hoping to cover today. Oh, good. Thank you. As generativity. This is spring. This is the period of generativity. This is also the major thrust of Jonathan Dittrain's major thesis, soon to be forthcoming in a book, although maybe not too soon. Just to give you a brief synopsis of it, John's paper entitled The Future of the Net and What We Can Do to Stop It takes first an assessment of the net as threatened by essentially three major forces and counsels that anyone who has the good of the net at heart would do well to attend to these forces, take them seriously rather than just treat them as the devil, figure out what the real strength of their position is, and figure out a strategy for dealing with them. It may be a strategy of retreat, but it requires identification of what the core is that you are defending with your strategy, what is the castle keep, so to speak. But then the forward thrust of the paper is that the real strength of the net is not in its defense, but in its generative power, that what has kept the forces of darkness away from the core of the net to this point has been essentially a quality of awe at the energy that the net has let loose. There's a slight subtext, can be read or not read as you choose, that it may be that this huge burst that we saw of internet generativity in the 90s has waned somewhat, at least in public perception, so that in the balance of power between the expansive force of the net and the forces that would contain it, the containment forces have been gaining strength and, in fact, could be at a critical point if things don't change. So into that environment comes an affirmative strategy that I want to focus on today. It's the generativity part of the strategy that I'm interested in talking with you about today. It's one that says, if you look at the landscape right now, we have remarkable technology for connecting and actually some quite remarkable technologies for processing connection. So far, we've not seen those put to enormously great use in terms of generating content. In a sense, the premise of what I'm describing is that there is almost like a vacuum for content, and so we're looking for designs to fill it. I've titled this Media Democracy. Media Democracy is an idea that has its roots in Terry's notion of semiotic democracy. It has its roots in Ethan Zuckerman's work about maldistribution of media attention around the world, and it has as its objective the idea that by using the power that we have as an identity in the rhetorical space represented by the net, the power that we have as the Berkman Center, as Harvard Law School, Harvard University, as who we are, it should be possible with existing technology to listen to global voices, to use the power to listen, and then to work with what we hear in ways that create audience and shift the balance of audience in a way that works towards media democracy. This one, which one do I get from? Oh, this one. Excellent. All right. Now, we're at a point where we're beginning the spring, and I wanted to put before the group the possibility that we largely orient our spring to productivity projects, that we become project-oriented as a group. I thought that a way to start that would be to use the form that is available to us, that is, use the tools of generativity, and see if we can explore them, get used to them, learn how you actually make things with them. And the two that have most appealed to me are the combination of the wiki and a slightly reformulated H2O. Now, I'm sure there are many here that are more familiar with the wiki than I am. Who feels at home with wiki? All right, just a few. All right, well, wiki is very simple. It is a structure built with software for processing knowledge to a product. Essentially, it's a software that creates a circle of people in which the rule is that anyone can edit the core document. Anyone. And the resulting document is ultimately the product of the collective group. It's extraordinarily simple, easily grasped. The impression that most brought it home to me was the recognition that the wiki has now generated the Wikipedia. People are familiar with Wikipedia? This is actually a knowledge product that is outstripping the established knowledge archive of my youth, which was the Encyclopedia Britannica. This was like Gibraltar. And the idea that the wiki, as a way of combining distributed contributions of an intellectual sort into a finished linear product, could be outstripping it, is just immense. All right, now, if you...
You can show us a wiki chat.
I want to show you a wiki.
Your wiki?
Let's see if I can light the screen up here. Our wiki.
This are you taping this, by the way, Charlie?
Yes. I am an audio blogger.
Did you clear permission?
I think he's clearing permissions right now.
I mean, I don't mean to FERPA object to anything, but FERPA.
Does anybody object to being audio blogged? You could email
it to
another
fashion.
The chilling effect.
Yeah. So here is a blog. This is our blog. I have listed a bunch of projects by simple names, which I hope before we get finished, we can describe. You should be able each to go to that URL, come in on it. You should be able to start putting your names down on the list, editing. You know, this is our space.
What's the password?
Does it require a password?
Yes, it does require a password. I believe the password is ILC student.
And what's the username?
Oh, excuse me, that's the username. The password is ILC password.
That's secure.
All no, lowercase.
All lowercase. Ram it all together.
Should faculty be signing up too?
By all means. This is colleagues, friends. So before you get too distracted on this, I want you to think about this in combination with a slightly modified form of H2O. You're all familiar with H2O. In its present form, H2O, to my mind, has a certain nagging quality to it. You keep getting done because you haven't filed the stuff yet. But here's the reformed H2O. The idea is, let's imagine ourselves as a group working on a project. that is manifest in the wiki. If, as one of us is working along, a question comes up, H2O would permit us to ask the question to the group without disturbing the wiki, not on the wiki, but in H2O. Then anyone in the group that wants to respond is free to do it. But no compulsion. If you do respond, you know you're going to get a response to your response. And the idea is that the person asking the question, who's looking for assistance in whatever they're trying to do with respect to the wiki, has this instrument of aggregating advice that seems potentially powerful. All right, so that's the idea of form. Now, how do I get back?
My God.
Here we go. Good for you. And now, oops, other way. Good. All right. So what's the mission of this enterprise? It's part of the idea of just lighting up cyberspace. What does that mean, practically speaking? It means that the essence of what we're trying to do is to figure out new ways of generating knowledge, but also of explaining how we do it, and doing it with readily accessible tools. That is, to make the methodology completely transparent. So preference for open source, preference for relatively inexpensive, as against relatively expensive. And if we can figure out ways of, at the meta level, processing knowledge to more useful products, and if we can propagate the methodology for doing it, then we have a shot at lighting up cyberspace here, media democracy. It's a very nice objective. I am going to ask Rebecca McKinnon, who will be, in a sense, more than one sense, head of our Global Voices enterprise, if she will just say a word about what she sees.
Well, I think what we're trying to do is a number of things. As Charlie mentioned, we see the fact that the mainstream commercial media, it decides what is and is not important for the rest of the world to know, or what's important for you to know about the rest of the world. There are a lot of conversations, a lot of things going on that you don't hear about. There are groups whose issues are not heard. They don't have access to media. We now have this situation where technology enables anybody to create media, get their voices out. So we want to really create a model and help people have access to the tools and have awareness to the tools so that they can produce their own media from any part of the world. And also to know what the legal issues are in their particular region or country in terms of, you know, what's going to get you thrown in jail. You know, in some countries, putting certain kinds of media products on the web could get you thrown in jail, or, you know, hacking internet systems in a particular way could get you in trouble. Certain kinds of communications technically are more possible in some countries than others just because of the regulatory environment. You know, some places it's illegal to use voice over IP, and in other places it's not. And so to help guide people through the system, but also try and advocate for more open regulatory and legal environments in all countries so that citizen media can thrive, and to help people who want to be activists to move freedom of speech in a more positive direction, you know, what they should do. As an example, we are hoping to be creating our own podcast, our own blog, to show, to point to some of the most interesting speech that's taking place around the world in various communities as an alternative to what the mainstream media might be saying, point to them, and also to serve as a model of what's possible. You know, here's a podcast, here's how you can do it yourself, on your mobile phone from Ghana, or you know, here's a streaming video cast, and here's how you can do it from Malaysia. Here's how you can use different technologies and get them out in different ways to the people you want to reach using the internet. So that's basically what we want to do, and there are a number of, I guess, subsets of that. We want to create a wiki that would really guide people to find sources of citizens media around the world, and have people around the world contributing to this wiki, which would serve as a reference guide. We'd also be working with new aggregation technologies and RSS and tagging technologies with something called Delicious to help point people towards what is most interesting and help people aggregate it themselves, use these tools to find what they want, because right now there's such a cacophony developing on the web. It's hard to know where to go and what's interesting. There are starting to be some tools that help you wade through this cacophony. And we want to help people find these tools so that it doesn't just become yet another situation where mainstream commercial media is helping people find everything, because it's sort of impossible to find anything useful throughout the cacophony of random blogs and so on that's out there. So we're hoping that this can be a real leading force in citizens media, and also in open source software development, really encouraging the open source software development community to create tools that can be used all over the world at no cost. Also, when it comes to Creative Commons and intellectual property, how that needs to evolve and how that should evolve globally so that people will be free to speak their minds, and that the content they really need to be able to sample, for instance, leaders' speeches, they'll be able to sample a soundbite from a speech by one of their leaders and put it in their own report without getting nailed for copyright violation by the state-owned broadcaster who's controlled by the government. And this is why Creative Commons can be a very powerful force on that side. And internet governance, how should the governance of the internet evolve in a way that promotes free speech? And right now, the mainstream media doesn't really cover much to do with WISE's World Summit on Information Society, the United Nations, or ICANN, for that matter. And so we're hoping to encourage people to pay more attention to that and to really track what's going on and link it to their future of their own freedom of speech on the web. So that's kind of a range of things. But it all circulates around this Global Voices idea that technology has finally allowed a more democratic conversation to take place. But it's not just because the technology is there doesn't mean that the conversation will evolve in a democratic way. We've got to facilitate that. And that's what we're hoping to do.
So questions for Rebecca? Who's got one?
Probably getting ahead of this, but I'm interested in how you describe the current cacophony of just content. There's so much out there, so many people are speaking, and it's true, there are tools to develop things to deal with that, but at the moment it's so much easier to get quickly overwhelmed by all the voices. How do we chart the direction that not only cuts through that, but avoids the risk that I see what makes things even worse, because at least with the mainstream media, flawed as they are, there's this idea of a common denominator of knowledge that everybody has. Back when there were three networks, everybody watched them, at least everybody kind of knew the same basic stuff, however narrow and slanted it was. And as the number of voices proliferate, there's at least some risk that instead people will select out to hear things that are in line with what they already know, or in line with what they already believe, and become more and more isolated and insular, and so you'll lose all of this commonality. How optimistic are you that the tools to cut through all of this confusion and really give people an ability to meaningfully distinguish all these voices will really get us there in the near future?
Well, I mean, it's hard to predict, but I guess it is a reality that the cacophony is out there, that the mainstream media is no longer in control of information, and that we're no longer in this world of free broadcast networks, and everybody believes the New York Times, that no matter how it evolves, no matter whether people become more ghettoized or choose to ghettoize themselves in terms of their information, or whether people do openly submit themselves to a broader range of view, the cacophony is there to stay. And so the question is, okay, the cacophony is there. How do you ensure that that conversation is truly balanced and that everyone has equal access to that conversation? Because right now, our colleague Ethan Zuckerman has been pointing out in his research, blogosphere, this cacophony, is dominated by white people in developing, white sort of upper middle class people in developed countries. And so how do you bring in more voices and help them achieve equal weight so that this the global media agenda, because increasingly you've got the voice of blogs now gaining the attention of mainstream media, which increasingly is taking its cues for its news coverage from bloggers. But if this conversation and this feedback loop is increasingly skewed towards a particular demographic, that's really dangerous. So one of the goals is, again, I mean, we can't, ultimately, you can't force people to be diverse in their thinking if they insist upon not being. But what can we do to try and promote as much diversity of conversation as possible? I mean, in a way, that's really all you can do. Since you can't really do one project change the world exactly, but you can certainly try and point to what the possibilities are and try to have some impact. Policies that make it possible for these diversity of opinions to really come out and ensure that bloggers in Morocco are not being thrown in jail for having an opinion that's independent of that.
JP,
I just want to make a point of order to help with Charlie. I'm fearful that it's possible that somebody in this room might have something to say but which they would not want to appear on the Eon Talk tomorrow.
Okay.
The event that they did would be okay. You're good with editing software, right?
Uh-huh.
So if somebody here wants to say something that is not on the Eon record, could they at the beginning of their statement say this is not for attribution on the Eon blog? And then
yeah, better than that, I'll just turn the recorder off.
I'm not trying to.
That's, no, say yes.
Okay. 4 years of experience. But either way.
Sure.
I just want to make sure that we get a live play.
So, can I ask you, Rebecca, you've articulated trying to broaden the range of inputs. Is there also a sense of how you would narrow it?
Well, we would certainly, I mean, we're going to have a blog that's going to have an audio component, or that's the idea. And certainly we would be pointing to things that we think have value in our own opinion. But we'd be doing it on a model saying, look, this is what we think is interesting, but everybody else is welcome to create their own blog or whatever that points to what they think is most important. And here are here's the wiki with the raw resources you can go to find what you want. But yeah, I mean that's why we do think that there is a role for a human editor ultimately in this conversation, rather than just having random RSS feeds spewing out stuff off of blogs that ultimately you want. You're going to have somebody going through this stuff and saying, well, this story coming out of Iran from this blogger is really huge and people really need to pay attention to it and nobody in mainstream media is talking about it.
And that'll be you.
Yeah, and other people too. Hopefully there'd be students involved in helping to identify this stuff. Is this stuff that's going on in people's home countries that they're familiar with?
Think of how well situated in a way we are with the student body that we have, the number of countries from which they come, people who are fluent in English and yet also in their vernacular. And if you're trying to imagine a form, I think that it's least been helpful to me to just think in terms of the Crimson. It's a student newspaper, all right? We're talking about a student online newspaper. There's a lot of people that would invest themselves in editorial judgment with the regional responsibilities of people who have particular knowledge of particular areas, and at least there's an organizational form that would allow. All right, sorry. Yes, Susan.
I'm just wondering, despite everyone being equal in democracy, I think there's some more philosophy that have more authority than others. I'm just wondering what you think about credibility. Granted, there's a lot of credibility issues with big media people, but how that sort of plays into it.
Well, I think there's multiple issues. Yeah, I mean, you definitely do see an ecosystem evolving in cyberspace where there are voices that have more authority than others, and they're kind of pointing to things that they think is interesting, you know, and farther down the scope of the tail. But that's, in a way, what we're doing. Sure. I mean, essentially, the tail, as it's described, is the vast majority of blogs and other things like wikis and so on that may have, you know, a few dozen people looking at them, really. You know, no big readership, viewership of any kind, but what they're saying in kind of gets pointed to and filtered up by the sites and blogs that have larger viewerships of several hundred people, and those are linked to by much smaller groups of both mainstream media as well as what are getting to be known as A-list bloggers that have thousands, tens of thousands, thousands of viewers, but it's sort of like this tail is percolating up interesting ideas that are feeding into the head.
So go back one step from the tail. There's a theory that may be familiar with, power law distribution theory. It basically says that the citizens' media space or the blog space of the internet is defined on a sort of standard power law or rate of distribution. There's some dispute as to what exactly it looks like, but they sure did, and why he was made this case to try and jump in. One interesting thing about it, is I think Rebecca's notion is, so yeah, there are a handful of people in the few people, but lots of readers, top end of the power law, that are just enormously popular. So it's dependent on yourself and others who get a couple hundred readers a day. They actually make money doing it. They're extremely well cited by other people, but then there are people who write from places where there are smaller readerships or languages that are otherwise not as populous on the web. Some surprises in terms of what languages are and aren't. But one interesting fact is that literally by citing to somebody who's in the tail, who happens to be in an area of the web that has less good Google PageRank, you actually affect where that person falls in the power law to some extent. So it's very much a live sorting process that happens as you do the act of blogging. So just to abstract it a little bit less, in the instance that Rebecca and Charlie are talking about, if you're at blogs.law.harvard.edu, which is the free blog server that we put up, it turns out fairly instantly it had huge Google juice statistics. The page rank of each of the pages in that universe on that tree of blogs that a lot of times they do is enormous relative to other blogs and other instances. There are a variety of reasons for this. I was talking to a consultant the other day who gets paid to drive people's page ranks up, and he said that Google, these are all guesses, right, but one is that .edu sites tend to have a better likelihood of being a valuable link in than a .com link. In some ways, you know, if this is true, if you have the luxury of being a Harvard.edu link, you also then have sort of Uber power in that regard. So it is remarkable in some ways the opportunity that this URL provides as the tree off of which to hang lots of interesting things. But literally just to be linking outwards has huge power, particularly if you go into the tail where a little bit actually affects a great deal of the traffic and the likelihood of somebody finding Google.
Which brings to the credibility issue, and yeah, the sites that have the greatest traffic are the ones that are perceived to be having the greatest credibility. And that's where we think that people who we believe we have integrity, you know, worthy of credibility and so on, you know, other people might be free, But if we're pointing to things that we think really deserve attention, that we will be helping those voices get heard, and that that's what it is. And that we're helping to give them credibility.
Josh,
I just want to give us a question about compensation. I think you mentioned that some folks are getting paid with the blog. Funny that it's so anathema to the whole ethos behind blog, particularly developing countries like this. But it's great that we've got these folks with all the time for lack of a life or grant money that can spend a long time developing a good blog. But it seems to me that inevitably the best and the brightest are going to be trying to make a living. So is there some train of thought going on here about how to reach out to those people that might actually be great bloggers that aren't doing good in our competition?
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I mean, most bloggers in other countries that I know of, I mean, there are some American bloggers who are starting to make quite a lot of money on Google Ads, several thousand dollars a month.
Right. The high end of this, at least anecdotally, is $100,000 a year.
Right.
That's what Glenn Reynolds makes on top of his blog professor salary, and that's the best you could
do. That's the best you could ever do. I know of some European bloggers who are making their money. I haven't heard of anybody, say, like in Iraq or Iran or China, who's making money off their blog. So why are they doing it? It's very interesting. The Iraqi bloggers, some of whom we've actually had here at Harvard recently.
Everybody here came to that conference.
Oh, good. Yeah, a lot of the faces are familiar. But the Iraqi bloggers, why are they blogging? Because they feel that the outside world doesn't understand what they think Iraq is, or it doesn't understand their point of view about what Iraq is, and that they have something to say and they want it to be heard, and they think it's important for their own future that the outside world understands them better. So it's not a monetary, it's not a financial incentive, but there are some people who have kind of non-financial reasons why they want to spend time blogging, or there's a cause that they really, you know, maybe there's some environmental abuse going on in Central Asia and there's a group that starts blogging about it. But yeah, there is that question of time. And other people blog because it enhances their reputation. If they have a highly trafficked blog, they'll get hired as consultants, or they might get hired to write articles for pay. They might get invited to speak if they're paid for it. Or they might get hired especially
as
a journalist,
as a result of the blog. But Josh, I'm sorry, Josh. Do you think this is, I mean, this is a perfectly good question. If there is no business model, say forget blog ads or Google or compensation from the President of the United States or a candidate for President of the United States, forget any of that, right? And there's no compensation involved. It's literally a labor of love. Does it succeed?
Well, it remains elitist forever. I think it's condemned to that. But I think if they get back to, you know, developing world, good trust in my questions, but I just can't go, Google could be a good business model. Maybe $100,000 a year, okay, why not? But particularly in developing countries, you mentioned the fact that the only people who get would be automatically agenda that have time to go to access to technology. And they are the folks that are trying to get out what they want to see in Iraq, what they want to see. Right? The folks that might have the most valuable stuff to contribute to the blogosphere don't do it, because there is no business model for voting development. Well, I'm just wondering if there's any additional opinion on that.
Yeah, well, that's a really, really good question. And, you know, maybe it would be really, if there were some foundation or media company that wanted to tap into truly unique voices, maybe they should start seeding and funding bloggers around the world. I don't know. That's a possibility, but you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm thinking about China. You know, there's 500,000 blogs in China, and why are most of them blogging? Most of them are not actually blogging for political reasons, they're blogging for social reasons. They're blogging for the same reasons that people are in chat rooms.
I practice this one fact for you, Yvonne, which is, we wrote a report recently on the blocking of blogs in China. So the short story is that the Chinese government blocked the three main for live streaming of September, and then they came back after they brought them back up and started filtering by keyword, But when we sent this out to people, reviewers, we got blamed immediately for not for having generate inaccurate results on the testing, but because we underestimated the number of Chinese sluggers in the ocean were, we had produced some data that was 3 or 4 months old that said there were 300,000, and immediately came back to the Chinese sluggers and said, oh, there's 600,000 of them, and it's doubling every 3 months.
It's really interesting that this community of conversation and sharing that doesn't necessarily have a financial motive, but has other motives. Maybe it's gathering together around particular interests. You know, people are really interested in mountain biking, and they all have blogs, and that's kind of what they use to communicate. But, you know, by the way, they also start bitching about environmental problems that's mucking up their, you know, mountain biking or something like that. And then it sort of becomes pseudo-political, but, you know, not really.
Your worry actually segues into the same earlier problem with credibility. Now, to me, you look at what's happening, you can see that the initial motivation, and a very substantial motivation, is that people simply love to express themselves and to do it in a way that has some possibility of response. That's huge. That's built Wikipedia. That's big time. Second, people somehow understand that however it happens, it becomes a potential asset to have celebrity. Celebrity can be monetized. Not necessarily in a direct equation, and here it is, I did this and now I get 2 cents back, but somehow celebrity pays off. And third, your idea of people being paid to blog, some see as much more of a threat. The much more likely people to be paying people to blog are marketing corporations who see this as a new communications environment in which they want to shape the rhetorical context in which their products are understood. So that then becomes a threat to credibility in the system. But I feel that these are problems to be met as they arise. You know, we're just at the beginning. And if we simply harness the expressive power of people who want just do it for fun, it would already be immense. And so we'll come to the next problem when we come to it. So.
Yeah. And there's a Chinese site that is just devoted to animations that random people make and post on the site. And it's, again, entirely they want to express themselves and share it with other people. So, yeah, that urge is...
By that coming, actually.
And they want to be respected by their peers for being smart and saying eloquent things.
Tim, did you do that because you've got a question? You were just getting frustrated.
This is my form of expression.
We learned our remarkable thing about Simon Bernstein earlier today. Not only the fact that Paul Lodzic, as many of you may know, he knows that there are certain fonts that the Supreme Court will not accept in an amicus brief at certain size levels. So Times New Roman must be 12 points.
No.
Cairo.
That is true.
No.
All right, so shall I charge you?
My Wingdings brief was a real...
That was a banger.
Yeah.
Charlie, I
have
a couple of questions.
Yes, sir.
For you or Rebecca, this is vaguely related. The focus on celebrity, Google rank, eyeballs, that's so common in this space. It's a little puzzling when you compare it to other spaces now. So, like scholarship, for example. Now, standards of reputation and credibility of scholarship are complicated, but there is definitely a countercurrent to popularity in scholarship. So,
does that include scholarly citation?
Well, there are two currents here. There's the University of Chicago-driven citation count, picked up by the Yale Law School librarian and updated regularly, which confers respect and aura on those who reach the purpose. But there is a countercurrent, which is presumed credibility on the basis of specialty and narrowness of coverage. So that we've, in history, for example, an historian who writes a biography of X that is accessible to and read by lots of people is understood to be engaged in a valuable social service, but if you wanted to find a source that would be reliable on X, you wouldn't go to that, you would presume that's not the right source to go to. You go to a different source that is just not. It's presumed not to make the compromises necessary for accessibility. So it's to return to what Charlie provoked, a complicated set of factors that in different subsets and different times for the scholarly community for credibility. There's been such a strong push in this space toward perceiving either as credible absolutely, or credible as a gateway, those who can claim the widest circulation. And so Google Juice or eyeballs are all variants on this basic phenomenon. So beyond just observing, well, to some extent, we have, we in an odd sense, not a government and not we democratically, but just by acquiescing in the emergence of organizations like Google, participated in the construction of a set of institutions that reinforce this, that drive it. Is it pernicious? Is there something wrong here? Or maybe is this a more honest and accurate test of something to care about than the muddled, somewhat fuddy-duddy, green eye shade British celebration of narrowness that prevails still in the
That's an interesting point. And there are actually a lot of blogs that do not seek widespread popularity, but have great credibility with community investors.
North
Korea,
that
would
be
perhaps
fine. There are others as well, but
I know of one that in the criminal evidence field. A professor, I should know his name, but this celebrity is kind of focused on Blakely, the issue before the Supreme Court about the sentencing guidelines. And he just made himself the repository of what there is to know about Blakely. And this is an obscure guy at the University of Cincinnati. He is now the guy on Blakely.
So obscure. You can't remember.
Well,
I
operate under the uncertainty principle. I don't know who half my colleagues are, but no, I'm only joking. But I think what Rebecca says is quite right. You don't need to feel a huge audience in order to feel fueled.
Right. So, for instance, this one. We have sort of a group of people who follow North Korea and post links on all kinds of details of things going on related to North Korea, much of which is not actually English, which is a lot of which isn't. And it's got a consistent viewership of about 500 people a day, and it kind of stays at that level. And a lot of the people who visit this site, I happen to know, are journalists, people in policy, people in academia who follow North Korea, people in the military, aides on Capitol Hill, you know, that kind of thing. It's not something that Instant Pundit links to, although he has linked to it once or twice in the traffic, and then, you know, he's just got off again because it's a bit too obscure and so on. But it's turned into a useful resource with some credibility amongst the community and its success in North Korea.
Rebecca, you should know, was bureau chief for CNN in China, mm-hmm. and then spent time in Japan, Korea, and is very well acquainted with that part of the world.
Maybe tell the story. I mean, they're relevant facts. I think the very question ultimately in the situation in North Korea with respect to content in and out,
right?
But then also how this started with, I think, their interesting facts.
Yeah. Well, I mean, basically, I started the blog about a year ago now. As part of the project I was doing on blogging and journalism and international news, but also out of frustration that I had been involved with covering the North Korean story for CNN, and I've been there, but I felt our coverage wasn't very good within the format that we had, and that I didn't think any American media covered the North Korea story very well, and that almost part of the reason is that there's so little access to North Korea, it's almost impossible to confirm most information that trickles out of North Korea, even if you go into that country, they're so controlled and really sort out what's really happening most of the time. And so, in a way, you're almost better off having a site like a blog where people are posting links to everything they can find on North Korea from every point of view, from every source, and then people can go and triangulate what seems to add up and what doesn't, and have a discussion in the comments section and sharing information, trading off and going through things to try and figure out what's really going on, and then inviting people who've been in North Korea to email in firsthand accounts of what they've seen, what they know, and posting on the blog, and that in a way, as a primary source to go to, again, you know, it's not something that we ever had tremendous traffic, but it's as a primary resource for trying to figure out what's going on in North Korea, it ended up being quite useful. But again, you know, it's never something that we have in that audience, and it doesn't go up into the house.
I'm struck by the sort of similarities between Charlie's point, the other point about this sort of the mass audience versus the sort of this community. It seems like you end up replicating the existing media in the sense that the existing media knows that there's much deeper ways of looking at the story, that there is much deeper information sources, in the same way that academic scholarship has, you know, a very deep understanding of certain areas. But when it becomes the point to turn the corner and project to the masses, you simplify. You sort of force into a situation where you reduce the way to get the message across. Do you see that process happening sort of fundamentally differently when blogs are involved than when newspapers and other forms of media are involved?
That's a good question. To some extent, yeah. I mean, with some of the high traffic blogs, Marquette perhaps makes a good example. You'll see sort of more entertainment, gossipy, kind of fun stuff as being used as a way to drive more eyeballs, and then they can point to serious things as well. Vaguely shocking pictures from time to time. I mean, I do know that the bloggers do it in an effort to get traffic to kind of put stock porn pictures on their blogs every once in a while in between the political commentary.
That worked great for NK Zone.
Yeah, you know, there you go. Actually, there's several South Korean bloggers who do that a lot. Or in between their commentary on U.S. forces in South Korea, is what it's about. But I guess to get back to your point, yeah, I mean, there's definitely those blogs who are trying to go for wider audiences do try and cater to what they think tastes and interest level, intellectual level of that mass.
The correlation with usage between those that you described as kind of the sort of emergent A-list mm-hmm. and those that have that kind of mass focus, is it if you overlap, I mean, if you have,
yeah.
who are able to sort of in that category.
Although at the same time with the big A-list bloggers, they're really serving a different function than a mainstream media organization. Because the mainstream, say the New York Times or say CNN, it's sending its people out, they're doing original reports. Most A-list bloggers are not getting much of their own original information. They're pointing to stuff. And so you're going to Iskra Pundit not for his brilliant original reporting, but because he's going to point you to stuff you wouldn't have found otherwise without spending all day searching the web. And so it does serve, it's not entirely parallel. Now he's going to be pointing to stuff that you know, fits a broad range of it. You know, he's not only going to be pointing to stuff on mechanical engineering or something, but it is a different model in a way because the blogs tend to aggregate across length and send you out a lot more than these readers, which is to be on or watching that station or reading that paper or on that website.
Shoot.
I'm not trying to phrase this exactly, but you saw
sort of in your introductory comments threw out a range of different goals, some being, like you said, more democratic content creation, giving more people cameras once they consume new stuff. The others sort of being more democratic content hierarchy making. We're going to use tags, we're going to use Flickr, and we're going to get everybody to tell everyone what you like. And then somewhere in there was open source tool generation and sort of these things. Do they actually, in your mind, how does that all fit together? Is there actually a hierarchy? And what does the hierarchy serve? Like, at some point, do you need a king to say, like a blog, you know, that this is interesting, this is not, I suggest you go read Ori and don't read CNN. Or is there some way where everything can be democratic, where the people will actually speak and will, in large numbers, point to much stuff?
In a way, I mean, we would have a blog where we are pointing that already, you know, seems to be much more balanced and sane than this other person who seems like, I mean, you know, that has a huge agenda or something like that, you know, trying to balance things. But at the same time, creating the tools that anybody can replicate and creating a resource where people could go raw to raw conversations so that we wouldn't be claiming to have a final word on this, but lending our credibility and our collective expertise to try to come to one picture that we think is relevant and important.
So I propose that I... Oh, go ahead.
Just one... Well, actually, you're a graphic designer.
I drive right here.
it seems like this, within Walt's and Jeff's and Josh's question is that... I think they all sort of come together in what Terry asked you, Regan, which we didn't frankly answer fully, right? I mean, your answer to Terry's question was, yes, some people do it for other reasons. Where are the niche people who are like the historians who write not about, you know, Thomas Jefferson, but write about somebody who doesn't be represented? It seems like it in some ways boils down to a couple of questions, none of which are truthfully answered yet, and in some ways is a research agenda. There's kind of a positive question first, right? So why do people do this? Like, what are the, you know, incentives that, Josh Gordon's question, I don't know, but also Terry's, is it because you're after some celebrity, like the celebrity you get at the media count in the real world? Is it because you want Google Juice and then be able to use it, test it, right, and things like that? Or is it that you're happy to be the guy who knows the most about some single Supreme Court precedent out there in the world? And there are, we can all cite lots of these people who are in the black space. I don't think we know yet. I think we know only that there's diversity in this way. But I think there's an interesting kind of empirical question or positive question to answer. And then there's sort of a second question, which is, so on a normative level, what space do we want to create? What are the values that are critically important? Maybe that's where Charlie started, citing Jonathan's paper, that there are a set of principles that we care the most about, which are some of these multi-democratic things you're talking about. But again, that's not neither well-defined nor something that's quite answered. And then there's sort of a third layer, which is there's a looking forward type of question, which is, I think this is from that entire point, we are making this every day in absolutely every way, right? So one is simply by using Google, we're succeeding to their algorithm and PageRank and how it works and all the rest. By choosing how we blog or how what blogs you set up or what podcasts you create, we're obviously doing that. So it's though it's funny, it's a physics experiment that once you step into it, it's all screwed up, right? We're in that zone very broadly, and I think on none of those levels, either sort of an academic matter or as a project matter, do we know the answer to those three questions.
The thing you identified, John, I think is built into the way we have undertaken to relate to our subject. We from the beginning saw ourselves both as observers and participants. And I felt it extremely strongly after Rebecca's and your conference, just whatever it was, I don't know whether everybody's in on it, but I came out of that feeling that I needed to become a blogger. I needed to participate. There was no way that I could really have informed opinions about it and have hands-on experience with the technology and somehow develop my instinct for how this space could be shaped unless I was in it. But at the very same time, my interest is very much in observing it as well. So I think it's implicit, and it's kind of like a conflict of interest that just comes with the territory, and it's like an ethical thing that you have to balance.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, so you don't have all the answers.
You don't have all the answers.
That you're seeking them as you build your project, and you adjust your project in sort of a wiki-like way as it gets used, and you find out how people are using it, what their motivations are, really, you know. Are they financial? Are they fame? Are they social justice or whatever it is? And as we discover that, then, you know, we may refine things in different ways.
So let me zip through the rest.